Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission here is simple: to give you the context, the surprising facts, and the, well, the deeper analysis you need to truly understand the figures who shaped our culture.
And today, we are opening the archive on a towering, contradictory genius.
A man often seen as the cool, collected anchor in the world's most anarchic comedy troupe, Monty Python. We are diving into the complex life of Graham Chapman.
You know, Chapman's popular image is, it's the straight man, isn't it? The character in a bowler hat who played authority figures like the Colonel.
Or the noble leads, King Arthur and Holy Grail and Brian of Nazareth.
Exactly. But our sources, they reveal a man who was anything but straight, anything but simple, and fundamentally chaotic. He was a brilliant, highly trained medical doctor who just discarded a guaranteed career for surrealism.
And a man who fought and defeated severe alcoholism.
And perhaps most importantly, he was a brave pioneer. I mean, one of the very first high-profile figures in Britain to publicly identify as gay back in the 1970s.
That is the core tension we're tackling today for you. How does a man with the discipline required to become a professionally registered medical doctor end up pioneering a form of anti-comedy?
Riding a non-existent horse.
And actively campaigning for social change. We're synthesizing his conflicting identities, the rigorous academic, the surrealist pioneer, and the trailblazer for openness, to unlock the surprising genius at the heart of the Python machine.
Our deep dive today is focused on those conflicting paths and the massive turning points that defined his too short life. From his humble beginnings in Leicester in 1941, all the way to that extraordinary, shocking memorial service that closed his story.
He really did spend his life challenging every form of authority, didn't he?
Absolutely. From the expectations of the British class system to the, well, to the established structure of the comedy sketch itself.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with that initial, almost impossible split, the path of discipline and the path of comedy.
Right. And to understand the origin of this contradiction, we need to look at his foundations. They were built on serious professional ambition and a kind of humility. Graham was born in Leicester, raised in Milton Mowbray, and came from a working background.
His father, Walter Chapman, is a great example of this. Walter started his working life trained as a French polisher.
Which is a very skilled trade, by the way. Long, precise hours.
Right. And he then joined the police force, eventually working his way up to the rank of chief inspector. I mean, that's a significant professional trajectory. It sets an expectation of rigor and respectability.
And that background, which he shared with his older brother John, meant they grew up with this distinct memory of an extremely poor upbringing. They were not encouraged toward the bohemian or the frivolous. Their environment demanded focus.
But even in that strict post-war setting, the surreal just intrudes.
Oh, absolutely. One of the most striking early memories Chapman ever recalled was seeing the remains of Polish airmen after a plane accident near Leicester.
Just a shocking, indelible image. A sudden dose of real-world absurdity and tragedy that just stuck with him. It's almost like the outside world provided him with the first visceral lesson in the chaos that lies just beneath the surface of everyday life.
And his education gave him the tools to manage that chaos. At Melton Mowbray Grammar School, he showed a strong affinity for science and sports, which suggests a very disciplined mind.
But crucially, he also excelled in amateur dramatics. He played Mark Antony in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and his performance was singled out in a review in the local paper.
So he's already balancing these two powerful competing pulls, the rigorous intellect and the stage.
He was also an avid fan of radio comedy, which tells us a lot about how his comedic mind worked. He loved The Goon Show, which was pure anarchy.
But he also loved Robert Morton, a comedian known for this almost structural deconstruction of humor. He was famous for reversing punchlines.
And here's where the analytical mind kicks in. His biographer, Jim Yocum, he noted that Chapman found these shows fascinating, but they didn't necessarily make him laugh.
Right. Which implies he wasn't just consuming comedy for enjoyment. He was analyzing the mechanics, the failure modes, the structural possibilities of humor. He was already dissecting the joke.
The great split really happened in 1959. He began reading medicine at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. This was the pinnacle of the respectable, stable path, the path his father had worked so hard to achieve for his son.
But naturally, Cambridge also housed the Cambridge Footlights, and that's where the discipline hit the disruption. He joined Footlights and immediately found his crucial writing partner, John Cleese. That collision was the turning point.
The lure of comedy was so powerful that he made an immediate, tangible sacrifice. He deferred his medical studies for a whole year just to tour New Zealand with the Footlights Review, Cambridge Circus.
That's not a hobbyist. That's a man who has made a choice, even if he thought it was temporary.
Yet the discipline ingrained in him remained. He didn't abandon medicine entirely.
Not at all. He returned, completed his studies at St. Bartholomew's, and achieved full professional registration as a doctor. He had the license, the qualifications. He could have diagnosed your serious illness.
But he chose not to. His brother, John, later clarified that Graham wasn't ever driven to go into medicine. It just wasn't his life's ambition. He was driven by that collaborative energy, the promise of comedy's instability.
And the professional comedy training began immediately in that vibrant 1960s BBC environment. David Frost, the leading impresario of the time, recruited Cleese.
And Cleese insisted on having Chapman. He needed him as a collaborator, as a sounding board. They were a package deal.
They became writers for hire, working for the top acts of the day, Marty Feldman, the radio show. I'm sorry, I'll read that again.
And even mainstream television shows for huge stars like Cilla Black and Tom Jones. This was their apprenticeship. It taught them pace, structure, and the demands of mainstream expectations.
All knowledge they would later use to deliberately subvert everything.
Chapman's first big step into performance came with, at last, the 1948 show, alongside Cleese, Tim Brooke Taylor, and Marty Feldman. This is where his persona started to solidify.
He was just perfect for deadpan delivery and mastering all these precise British dialects. It allowed him to play those stoic authority figures, like in that memorable sketch, The Minister Who Falls to Pieces.
Oh, that's a classic. It showcased his ability to maintain this rigid physical control while everything around him, or while parts of himself, literally fell apart.
And this preparatory work is absolutely essential because it provided the raw material for Python. The genesis of their most famous sketches comes from this period.
You're talking about the dead parrot sketch.
Exactly. While writing for the sitcom Doctor in the House, and later for a special called How to Irritate People, Cleese and Chapman developed this core frustrating scenario. A used car salesman refusing to believe a customer's car had broken down.
That kernel of relentless, illogical denial. The refusal to acknowledge an undeniable reality.
That was the immediate inspiration for what would become the dead parrot sketch. They realized the true comedy wasn't in the car breaking down, but in the salesman's utterly straight authoritative rejection of the customer's legitimate complaint.
The groundwork was laid. Take a mundane situation, introduce impossibility, and have the straight man deny it all with absolute conviction.
Precisely. And the most disciplined mind in the room was now ready to dismantle everything he had been trained to respect.
So by 1969, the stars aligned. Chapman and Cleese merged their material and their approach with Michael Palin, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Terry Gilliam.
And Monty Python's Flying Circus was born.
The group's writing process was famously unique, collaborative chaos, I think you could call it. But Cleese and Chapman, they maintained their exclusive partnership.
Yeah, they worked in isolation, then brought their material to the others. But here is the critical point, linking back to this idea of the intuitive genius. John Cleese often noted that Chapman contributed comparatively little in terms of direct writing output.
What does that mean, exactly?
Cleese described Chapman's process in almost mystical terms. He said Chapman would come in, say something marvelous, and then drift off in his own mind.
So Cleese was the structure builder, the architect of the premise, the dialogue.
Exactly, the scaffolding. Chapman was the unpredictable, nonlinear catalyst who could instantly make a functional sketch transcendentally absurd. If Cleese gave him A and B, Chapman would supply the disruptive factor Z.
We have to pause here because that explains why his genius was so revolutionary. It wasn't about crafting perfect prose. It was about sensing the most structurally damaging yet hilarious shift in logic.
And the tangible results of that intuition were profound.
The first being his role as the punchline killer.
Yes. Traditional British sketch comedy relied on the setup, the rising action, and the punchline. It gave the audience permission to laugh. Chapman hated that. He felt it was lazy. It prevented genuine surprise.
He didn't just advocate for removing the punchline. He literally embodied the destruction of the sketch itself. That is the character of the Colonel.
Absolutely. The Colonel wasn't just a funny character. He was a metacritical device. He would storm onto the screen, often in full military regalia, that symbol of ultimate, unassailable British authority, and stop the action mid-flow.
Declaring the sketch was simply too silly to continue.
And by critiquing the sketch within the sketch, Chapman achieved this powerful postmodern effect. He broke the fourth wall, prevented narrative resolution, and created that stream of consciousness, sketch-to-sketch flow, that defined Flying Circus.
It's structural deconstruction taken to its logical extreme. He took the discipline he learned in medical school, the need to dissect, diagnose, and remove, and applied it to the anatomy of comedy. He was performing structural surgery on the BBC's Expectations.
And that structural anarchy is perfectly evident in their most famous pieces. Take the evolution of the dead parrot sketch. As we discussed, the original idea was a faulty machine.
A linear comedy of frustration.
It's exactly. Chapman's crucial intervention was to push for chaos. He demanded, "How can we make this matter?" By changing the faulty toaster into a dead Norwegian brew parrot, they transformed the argument from a consumer complaint into an existential battle over whether the bird was, in fact, merely resting.
It moved from a simple gag to a philosophical, hilarious argument about denial and reality.
Anchored by Cleese's incredible outrage and the shopkeeper's calm, authoritative denial. It's perfect.
And then there's the cheese shop, which is maybe the purest distillation of Chapman's intuitive genius overcoming Cleese's structural skepticism.
Cleese found the cheese shop deeply unfunny during the writing stage. The premise is so simple. A man enters a shop wanting cheese, and the shopkeeper lists every single cheese he does not have.
Cleese saw no traditional payoff. It was just repetition and frustration. It violates every rule of sketch writing. The premise doesn't build to a gag. It just frustrates.
But Chapman, recognizing that the act of absolute relentless refusal was the joke, insisted. He famously told Cleese, "Trust me, it's funny."
And when they read it to the group,
the others loved it. Chapman instinctively understood that the sheer escalating effort required for the shopkeeper to deny the customer cheese was a surreal punchline. It confirmed his role as the great nudger of the absurd. Terry Gilliam said, "Graham would do the nudge that would push it into something extraordinary."
So despite this chaotic reputation in the writing room, when it came to the films, he was the preferred choice for the straightest, most demanding leads.
King Arthur in Holy Grail and Brian in Life of Brian.
Why him?
The consensus among the Pythons was clear. Graham was the best actor. Cleese specifically called him a wonderful actor. He had this stoicism, this believable screen presence that allowed the surrounding madness to bounce off him without dissolving into utter nonsense.
They needed an anchor. If King Arthur was as ridiculous as the French taunters, the entire film would just collapse.
Exactly. He had to carry the narrative weight. The other Pythons loved playing the smaller, weirder character parts, the crones, the guards, the prophets, but someone had to be the immovable center.
And he had that professional commitment. I mean, thinking about the challenges of Life of Brian.
Oh, absolutely. He had to be the believably stoic everyman martyr. He was even required to film a full nude scene, which he just took in stride.
And that scene, it had its own issues, right?
It did. The production highlight, or maybe lowlight, of that scene was that they were filming in Tunisia. And the sight of a completely nude Chapman caused some significant issues with the modesty of the female Muslim extras who were working on the film. Uh-huh. It's a perfect encapsulation of Chapman. Utterly unconcerned with convention or propriety, even if it caused professional headaches.
This stoicism, this ability to anchor the madness, is a real paradox, especially when you consider the chaos that was unfolding in his private life.
The chaos that earned him the nickname among the group, the late Graham Chapman.
Because he was chronically late for everything.
That nickname was affectionately earned. But it points to the incredible tension between his outward professional control and his intense inner battles. And that's where we pivot next. The battles for identity and sobriety.
Graham Chapman's professional genius was deeply interwoven with the intensity of his personal journey. And that was characterized by two major interconnected struggles, public identity disclosure and private addiction.
Let's start with his sexuality, where he was a true pioneer. Chapman first met his long-term partner, David Sherlock, in Ibiza in 1966. For Chapman, this was a deeply clarifying moment. He described realizing he was gay as an important moment in my life.
And he established this relationship immediately. They moved in together in Belsize Park in 1968, and then to a home in Highgate in the early 70s. Crucially, he did not hide this reality from his inner circle.
No, he told close friends like Cleese and Marty Feldman the following year.
But the truly groundbreaking moment came in 1972. Chapman made the decision to publicly disclose his homosexuality on a television show hosted by George Melly. And you really can't overstate how monumental and frankly risky this was at the time.
No, you can't. Let's contextualize that era for you. In the UK, the Sexual Offences Act of 1967 had decriminalized homosexual acts, but only privately and between men over 21. The social stigma was still massive, especially in the media and entertainment industry.
So for a mainstream comedy star to come out publicly in 1972, it was virtually unheard of. It put his career at risk. It required tremendous personal courage.
And he wasn't content just to live his life privately. He became an active, vocal advocate. He championed gay rights, supporting the nascent Gay Liberation Front, the GLF, which at the time was a pretty radical and politically charged movement.
He was also a staunch supporter of the pioneering newspaper Gay News.
Yes, where he was listed as one of their special friends. His money and his profile lent powerful legitimacy to these movements.
The reaction naturally was not universally positive. He often recounted an anecdote about receiving a letter during a college tour complaining about having a gay python.
And it cited a biblical passage about stoning. That speaks volumes about the environment. That specific level of vitriol was real.
The response from his colleagues, however, showed their solidarity.
Oh, completely. Eric Idle, in classic Python fashion, reportedly joked back that they had found the perpetrator of the gay act and already killed him, just absorbing the homophobic threat into their brand of absurdity.
Meanwhile, his family life continued to challenge convention. In 1971, Chapman and Sherlock took in a 14-year-old boy, John Tomachek.
He was a runaway from Liverpool. They became his legal guardians. This was a deeply unconventional family unit for the 1970s.
And John Tomachek remained a constant presence throughout Chapman's life.
He became not only a beloved family member, but eventually Chapman's business manager. His ability to build and sustain this chosen family speaks to the immense personal warmth beneath that anarchic veneer. It's very sad. Tomachek died relatively young in 1992, at age 35, from a heart attack.
And during the mid-70s, Chapman also joined a trend common among high-earning British entertainers.
He moved to Los Angeles to avoid the extremely high British income tax rates. He only returned permanently to the UK in the early 80s after the release of Yellowbeard.
Okay, so now we have to address the other massive personal battle that dominated his early career, alcoholism.
Right. It began early at Cambridge, where he developed a heavy dependency on gin. He was an active alcoholic from his university days right up until the late 1970s.
And the impact wasn't just personal, it became professional. By the time the Monty Python live tour took place in 1973, his drinking was severe enough to undermine his performance.
He would frequently miss cues to go on stage. He was struggling significantly. More dangerously, he was experiencing episodes of delirium tremens, or DTs.
Which is the most severe form of alcohol withdrawal.
Exactly. Confusion, rapid mood swings, hallucinations, severe shaking. Now imagine trying to anchor a live, chaotic comedy show while physically suffering from that. The contrast between the professional demand for stoic control and his physical reality was just immense.
So if this medical doctor understood the prognosis better than anyone, why did the addiction persist for nearly two decades? And what finally provided the drive to achieve sobriety?
The persistence, I think, speaks to the power of the addiction overriding the discipline. But the breakthrough came not from some sudden spiritual awakening, but from a professional challenge that mobilized his medical academic control. That challenge was Life of Brian.
He realized he couldn't successfully perform the demanding lead role in a major film production anchored in Tunisia, facing immense logistical challenges while drinking heavily.
So he decided to quit. He did it during Christmas 1977, and that decision was final. He stopped drinking and remained completely sober for the rest of his life. It was a rigorous clinical decision. Self-diagnosis, followed by absolute adherence to the treatment plan, the doctor finally took control of the patient.
Even amidst this intense personal recovery, he continued his work outside the Python umbrella. In 1975, he collaborated with the young Douglas Adams, co-writing the pilot Out of the Trees.
It was an attempt at a nature-based comedy. It was a solid effort, but it failed to get picked up for a series. And the reason really was the simple, brutal reality of British television scheduling.
It was broadcast opposite Match of the Day.
The massive football program, a comedic experiment, just couldn't compete with the national obsession with sport.
He followed that up with The Odd Job in 1978. He co-wrote and starred in this dark comedy about a man who hires a hitman to kill him, but then changes his mind.
And Chapman's initial plan for the co-lead was his friend, the legendary drummer of The Who, Keith Moon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Chapman adored Moon. He represented pure, unadulterated chaos. But Moon failed the acting test required by the film's insurers, and the part went instead to David Jason. Fantastic actor, but far more conventional. Just shows Chapman's constant desire to mix genius with true, volatile anarchy.
And that volatile mix finally led to his big, self-driven film project, Yellowbeard in 1983, a pirate movie that began life as a script idea for Keith Moon.
But Moon's untimely death in 1978 threw the project into developmental chaos. It was eventually rewritten by comedy heavyweights Bernard McKenna and Peter Cook. The film, which starred Chapman, turned into this massive, star-studded enterprise.
a literal constellation of British and American comedy genius. Cook, Marty Feldman, Cleese, Idol, Milligan, even Cheech and Chong.
But the production was a disaster. It was famously fraught with severe financial difficulties. They often simply ran out of money during the shoot. The irony is rich. Chapman, the man who perfected comedy through anarchy, struggled deeply when forced to manage a production that was simply uncontrolled.
It was also Marty Feldman's last screen appearance.
Yes, before his fatal heart attack. Critically, Yellowbeard received mixed reviews. One reviewer noted that trying to replicate the Python style required more than scatology, rude words, and funny faces. It needed the structural genius of the collaborative Python team, which the film lacked.
And in the midst of all this, he somehow found time to write his memoir, published in 1980.
With the perfect title for the man who loved structural subversion, A Liar's Autobiography. He chose it because, as he explained, it's almost impossible to tell the truth. He embraced the surreal and unreliable narrator structure for his own life story.
And finally, his pursuit of pure adrenaline, post-sobriety, is fascinating. He became heavily involved with the Dangerous Sports Club,
the group that popularized bungee jumping. This transition from the chemical high of alcoholism to the physical risk of extreme sports suggests a man who still craved the feeling of living right on the edge. He became a patron, enthusiast.
Although in a final ironic twist, his own scheduled bungee jump was canceled.
For safety concerns. Even the world of extreme danger decided that Graham Chapman was too precious to risk.
Graham Chapman's life was tragically cut short, but his final years were marked by characteristic resilience, and his death provided the platform for what remains arguably the most fitting, shocking, and culturally significant eulogy in modern British history.
The illness began quietly in 1988 during a routine dental visit. Doctors discovered a small, malignant tumor on a tonsil, which led immediately to a tonsillectomy. But the cancer was aggressive. It spread quickly.
By 1989, the disease had spread to his spinal column. Another tumor was surgically removed. He underwent extensive chemotherapy, several surgeries throughout his final months.
But despite this immense struggle, the cancer was ultimately declared inoperable. It was a prolonged and painful end to a life defined by physical and mental agility.
It was a time of immense emotional strain. He was, according to his brother, visibly upset by the death of his mother in July 1989, even while he was terminally ill himself.
And yet, despite his condition, he mustered the energy to film scenes for the 20th anniversary special, Parrot Sketch Not Included. That became his final television appearance with the surviving pythons.
He died on October 4th, 1989 at Maidstone Hospital from complications related to the spread of the cancer. He was only 48 years old.
The moment of his death was intensely private and deeply poignant. His partner, David Sherlock, his brother, John, Michael Palin, and John Cleese were all there.
And Cleese, who is famously emotionally reserved, was so overcome with grief that he had to be led out of the room.
Michael Palin captured that final quiet moment of surrender in his diary. He recalled holding Chapman's cold hand, telling him they loved him, and observing that final long inhalation, followed by a single tear that emerged from his right eye and rolled down his cheek before the silence descended.
And in a final anarchic piece of timing that only Graham Chapman could orchestrate, his death occurred on the eve of the 20th anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus's debut.
Terry Jones summed it up perfectly. He called it the worst case of party pooping in all history.
The surviving pythons understood that a standard sentimental farewell was completely inappropriate for a man who spent his life subverting sentimentality.
So they skipped the private funeral to prevent a media circus. They sent a wreath shaped like the iconic python foot.
And the message on that wreath was classic python. To Graham from the other pythons with all our love. P.S. Stop us if we're getting too silly.
The Rolling Stones also sent flowers, which is a wonderful detail, linking Chapman to that wider countercultural elite.
But the real spectacle was the public memorial service, held 2 months later in the Great Hall of St. Bartholomew's, the same institution where he had earned his medical degree.
And the service began with this deliberate, unsettling surrealism. A chorus of the hymn Jerusalem sung in English with a mock Chinese accent. It was instantly clear this was not a traditional Anglican service.
And then came the ultimate performance. John Cleese delivered a eulogy of pure shock humor, a true testament to Chapman's anti-sentimentality.
And this moment achieved a piece of minor cultural history, because Cleese delivered this sequence of insults intended to outrage, and in the process, he became the first person at a televised British memorial service to utter the word fuck.
It was magnificent. Cleese framed the insult as the final necessary act of love and respect for Chapman's subversive spirit. He said, and it's worth hearing the full quote, "I guess that we're all thinking how sad it is that a man of such talent should now so suddenly be spirited away. Well, I feel that I should say, nonsense. Good riddance to him, the freeloading bastard. I hope he fries."
And he continues, "And the reason I feel I should say this is he would never forgive me if I didn't, if I threw away this glorious opportunity to shock you all on his behalf. Anything for him but mindless good taste."
It was a stunning demonstration of Chapman's influence. He taught his friends to reject mindless good taste even in the face of death.
And Eric Idle follows suit. He quipped that Chapman decided to die rather than listen to Palin again.
Before leading the assembled crowd in a truly rousing rendition of Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
And Idle, recognizing the structural challenge set by Cleese, closed his remarks with the ultimate one-upmanship. He just said, "I'd just like to be the last person at this meeting to say fuck."
It brought the house down, the ultimate necessary punchline for the man who hated them.
Even in death, Chapman remained the central catalyst for Python's specific brand of chaos, generating wonderful legends that the surviving members continue to exploit.
His legacy extends into the literal heavens. Asteroid 961 Henan Graham Chapman is one of six asteroids named after the Pythons, a fitting monument for a man who often felt slightly detached from Earth.
And in a wonderful piece of physical commemoration, reflecting his dedication to living openly, a British Comedy Society blue plaque was unveiled at the Angel Pub in Highgate. That was his home with David Sherlock during the 70s.
And Michael Palin spoke at the unveiling.
He did. He summarized the complex man perfectly. A very good, brilliant, funny, nice, wise, kind man who occasionally drank too much.
The Pythons naturally refused to let him be defined by plaques. When questioned about reunion possibilities, Eric Idle summed up the situation perfectly.
"We would only do a reunion if Chapman came back from the dead, so we're negotiating with his agent."
And the stories surrounding his physical remains are just glorious. They keep his unreliable narrative alive.
Oh yeah, there were widespread rumors that his ashes had been blasted into the skies in a rocket by the Dangerous Sports Club, which, given his fascination with extreme risk, sounds entirely plausible.
Mm.
Or maybe they were scattered in Snowdonia, where he loved to climb.
The Pythons even incorporated his ashes into their public performances for years. At the 1998 Aspen Comedy Arts Festival, his urn was intentionally brought on stage.
Then accidentally knocked over by Terry Gilliam, spilling the ashes everywhere, which were then removed with a dustbuster.
But perhaps the most tender and intimate joke came from David Sherlock. When Idle remarked that he wished Graham was there, Sherlock replied, "Oh, but he is. He's in my pocket."
A constant portable presence, even in ash form.
His self-authored chaos continued posthumously through the compilation of his writings by Jim Yocum, working with David Sherlock and John Tomachek's Trust. Collections like Graham Crackers, Fuzzy Memories, Silly Bits, and Outright Lies.
Kelsey made interesting. They ensured his surreal voice and unreliable memory lived on.
And we got the ultimate posthumous appearance in 2012. The 3D animated film, A Liar's Autobiography. The untrue story of Monty Python's Graham Chapman.
Right, which used voice recordings he taped shortly before his death, with the surviving Pythons lending their voices to the animation.
The film's marketing campaign provided the perfect tagline, a quote attributed to Chapman himself. "This is the best film I've been in since I died."
So what stands out when we synthesize the life of Graham Chapman is the intensity of his defining contradictions. He was the disciplined doctor who rejected structure in favor of utter chaos.
The man who fought privately and brutally against alcoholism, only to reassert that inner discipline when his professional identity was at stake.
He was the stoic anchor on screen, the King Arthur, whose greatest contribution to comedy was an intuitive genius for pushing material beyond logic, demanding sketches like the cheese shop, even when the linear mind, embodied by Cleese, protested.
He taught comedy writers the power of following that intuitive nudge, even if it meant destroying the sketch structure entirely.
And his life exemplifies the profound importance of living openly. His courageous public disclosure and advocacy in 1972 were trailblazing. It gave him a legacy of identity that transcends his professional work. He was kind, wise, funny, and incredibly complex. A man who proved that the greatest control often comes from embracing one's own internal anarchy.
And here is the final thought for you to carry forward, building on this deep dive. The man who was most responsible for removing the punchline from comedy, the man who perfected structural deconstruction. He created a memorial service that became the ultimate unforgettable punchline of his own life.
What does it tell you about the nature of true comedic genius that the greatest legacy he left his friends was the glorious opportunity to shock an audience and say fuck on national television one last time?
A legacy only Graham Chapman, the straightest, most anarchic doctor in the world, could leave. Thank you for joining us for the Deem Dive.